That's the name of the title of my presentation, Past Family Memory, Negotiating Stories and Shaping Identities Across Generations. And it's a case study about a German-Canadian Winnipeg family whose elders are survivors in one way or another of Germany's troubled past. And the research itself explores how a family past is constructed through storytelling, how stories or memories are remembered, how they're told, how they're constructed, how they're created, how they're negotiated, renegotiated, reconstructed, that kind of thing, and how they help to shape individual and collective identity across generations. And the research is also about an exploration into a method of interview and an exploration into a theory of memory. And my study builds on the scholarship of others in this area of research. It's not something that I just came up with. In terms of the method of interview of exploration, it's the application of a three-generational one-on-one interview, traditional interview with each family member, and then the application of the somewhat less tried and less supported group or table talk method of interview, where the whole family together is interviewed together. And table talks are defined to be attempts that are set up to create family conversations that demonstrate how family memories and stories are communicated and constructed within the families, and how they help to shape the collective and identity of that family. And just a short note on the connection between oral history and memory. Oral history is about memory, and we know that there are two kinds. There's individual memory and collective or communicative memory, and that they're connected. So this means then that there is an individual and a social dimension. And individual memory is that which is located in our minds and through which we know things about our personal experiences. And collective or communicative memory is the way countries, cultures, nations, societies, groups, families, etc., develop and build a collective political and social identity and a collective system of values and beliefs and laws and rules. And so memories then are very much a part of who we are. We converse in events and experiences and happenings, and it's these things that help to shape and reshape the ways we remember and identify. Now I'm going to say something about my family of interview. Two of my family members are here today. Mom and one of her daughters. Unfortunately, the others were not able to come, but that's all right. So this is my family. Starting from the left is Oma, or Gisela Roger, her eldest daughter, Marguerite Roger, and her twin grandchildren, Madeline Roger and Lucas Roger. Her other daughter didn't wish to have her picture shown, and so she's not here today. So we honor that request. And so I interviewed an Oma and her two daughters and her twin sister-brother grandchildren. So there's a gender and a twin component to the study. There's a four-year difference between the two sisters, and the twins were 22 at the time of interview. All of the members were interviewed individually and then again together as a group. Opa was deceased at the time of the interview, so that's why he's not in it. And so there's their photo, and now here are some audio clips of their own introduction.
My name is Gisela Roger, and I'm 81 years old.
Marguerite Roger. I was born August 3rd, 1962. I was born in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Madeline Beth Roger. I was born in Winnipeg, Manitoba in 1991.
Well, I was born Lucas Benjamin Roger in the St. Boniface Hospital in Winnipeg, Canada.
Yeah. Okay. Excuse me for a minute. That little noise there, that voice, is the voice of my cat, Griffin. And I include him as, well, for a couple of reasons. One, as an example of how not to do an interview. In class, they teach us, of course, when you're interviewing something, that, you know, you have to be in a quiet room where there's absolutely no noise at all the phones are shut off. You know that nobody's going to come to the door. You know that there's not going to be any kind of interruptions. Well, my cat Griffin is an old cat, and he's also an outdoor cat. So he has to go outside to go to the bathroom because he won't use a litter box. Anyway, he slept through many, many interviews. But for this particular one, I guess he decided that he had to get up and go to the bathroom. Normally, I leave a window open for him to do that so he can go in and out on his own. But this interview was right in the middle of winter, and it was extremely cold, so the window wasn't open. So up he gets, and so that meant that I had to turn the mic off and stop the interview and let the cat outside. And then I thought, well, there's no point in restarting the interview until he's finished, because then I would just have to interrupt and get up and let him back in again. And so in the meantime, Kirsten and I just sat there and chatted about this and that and everything else. And in the end, she said, well, it's not so bad. She says, so I think it's always a good idea to have a cat break in the middle of an interview. And I wasn't really distressed by it either. I think another point is that, you know, even if you are interrupted in your interview, it's not the end of the world. It can still be picked up and you can continue. And the other reason that I wanted to add him to this, because his voice is now heard. And so now, because of oral history, he's now officially recorded into history and is no longer just a marginalized freak feline. So, okay, so next clip. Okay, so this is just a collage of Germany during Oma's childhood when she was growing up. And these are just some of the things that were happening and going on in Germany. And now I'd like to say a little bit more about Oma, or Gisela, because this is where the stories first started from as well, with her husband. And he was referred to an awful lot through all of the interviews, so I include him in that way. So Gisela Roger Nie Steiber Oma was born in Halle in East Germany in 1932. She was 6 years old when the Second World War broke out, and she was 13 when it ended. So she experienced the war as a child of war. And I think this is important to keep in mind, at least it was for me, when thinking through my analysis interpretation and when considering the public or official record of history and the private or personal remembrance of history. So, sorry about that. After the war, I'm just going to put that down there. After the war, she and her family were trapped in the Soviet-controlled block of East Germany behind the Berlin Wall. And one day, she remembers, the Russian soldiers came to her home and took her father away, and she was never to see him again. And her brother was killed in a bombing raid just prior to the end of the war. At around age 18, her mother encouraged her to try to leave East Germany, to try to escape. And she was successful in escaping across the wall into West Germany, where she lived for a period of time with relatives. And eventually, she felt that she had to get away from Germany altogether, as she felt that somehow she just didn't fit in anymore, that she was broken inside. And so she left for New York, where she worked as an au pair. And she tells me the story that just before she was ready to leave for New York, she bumped into and met her future husband, and they fell in love. And so he said to her, oh, so I guess now this means you will not be going to New York. Oh, yes, I will, she says. So away she went to New York. And then he kindly pestered her through the mail, and then proposed to her through the mail. So eventually she came back, they did marry, and then she and her husband went back to the United States. He was an architect, and it was very difficult at the time to get work in Germany, and he was able to get some in the States. So they stayed there for a while, where their first daughter, Margret, was born. And then they returned to Germany because both their parents were aging and ill, so they came back to take care of their parents. And then this is where their second daughter, Kirsten, was born. And then eventually the whole family immigrated to Canada and to Winnipeg in 1966, where they built a new life. And so these are just some of the pictures. The first one up here is a little piece of paper with some writing on it. While her father was imprisoned, he managed to get a hold of little pieces of paper, and he had a little tiny pencil, and he managed to write little notes and smuggle them out that eventually made their way to the family. And this little note suggests that it might be the last one he could do, because the lead in his pencil was no more. And this is Pier 21, Halifax, Nova Scotia. That's just where when they immigrated to Canada, that's where they first landed. And this is a little booklet. One of the ways that stories were told in this family was Opa and Oma would often make up little booklets about little stories of their lives. And this was one of the ones that was created. Okay, for the next one. And what I was interested in, I was interested in lots and lots and lots of things. One of the things, who tells the stories, and how they were told, and in what circumstances were the stories told, and how were they embraced, and how they were taken in. I was interested in how they identified as German or as Canadian or as German-Canadian across generations. I was interested in what identifies you exactly as German. And I was interested in what parts of German culture and traditions and expressions and values and beliefs have been carried over, which ones have not been, and what about you as German that you didn't realize was German? Did they experience any discrimination? What and how each generation understood about Germany's troubled past? How did they learn it? Where did they learn it? How did they reconcile their understanding with that? What are some of the hard things to say, and what are some of the stories that they would like told that haven't been told, and what are some of their fondest and happiest memories of German identity? And in terms of who told the stories and how they were told, each family member says, oh, Opa, 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 always Opa, Opa. He told stories, 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 all the time stories that he was... He was a big storyteller, and Margret shares with us that tons and tons, she said, of active work, especially my dad, to keep us connected to our family history, absolutely. She said there was almost an urgency in my dad that we never lose our understanding of where we came from, not necessarily about the country, but our family tree. We had pictures hung up of our forefathers, and my dad would inevitably pontificate about all these various people and what they had done and their names. And oh, heaven help us, she said, we could never remember all these stories. Old men, she said, with mustaches and things hanging all over our wall that we didn't know about. And she tells too, she said, as younger children, when they were just children growing up, one of the ways that stories were told, on Sunday nights, they would have board game nights in their home. And they always had dinners together, and she said, I think we often asked about stories, and for us, it was, I don't think we had any idea of what we were asking my parents to talk about. For us at that time as little children, it was an adventure, you know. It was to hear how you can fry potato peelings in wax to make dinner, or how you can go and gather stinging nettles to eat. And it was just wildly adventurous and brave and incredible to think that you could be so strong and capable and make do with so little. And you know, it was just, it felt miraculous that they had survived it. There were stories of my dad's train being bombed, and you know, I mean, it was, we never had the horror of it as a kid. that we have now as an adult. So that's just another way some of the stories were told. And what about the you as German that you didn't realize? For her children, the twins, who were 22, they were, just before the interview, they were embarking on a trip to Germany with their Oma. She was taking them on a memory trip through Germany, where she lived, where Opa lived, things that happened and this and that. And so I thought it would be a good idea to interview them before they went to Germany, like what's their feeling and what do they understand about their German identity and all that, and then it would be interesting to understand or interview them again when they came back after they'd gone on that trip. And initially, each of them identified, they said, well, they identify as Canadian with a German heritage and never really thought too much about German identity or what that might mean. And then Maddie tells a funny story when she came back. She says, oh my God, she says, one of the things, she said, I thought we were just a wacky, wacky family, she said, but it was the German ritual of saying goodbye after you'd had visitors in the house. Oh, yeah, and then it's time to say goodbye, and everybody would get up, and oh, yeah, yeah, kiss, kiss, hug, hug, thank you for coming, yeah, that was so nice, and nice to see you again, I hope we see you again, we might not see you again, but if we do see you again, and this chatter, and then they moved on to get your coats, and then they're getting the coats, yeah, 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 thank you for coming, goodbye, goodbye, yeah, okay, yeah, we'll see you, we'll see you, oh, did you get some food, you want to take some food here, you better take some food with you, and then they all trundle out the door, and now they're on the doorstep, and yeah, goodbye, goodbye, and they had this expression, cheers, 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 cheers. And she said this continued, and then, you know, out to the curb where the cars are, and they're all still out there, and finally the people all get in their cars, and they drive away, and she said, and if you look back, there's, you know, my family all waving, waving, and she said, I thought it was just odd until they had gone to Germany and to visit the relatives, and she said, oh my God, she said to Lucas, her cousin, oh, look at that, she said, it's a German thing. There's nothing wrong with our family at all. It's a German thing. Look how they're saying goodbye. And so that was kind of funny. And what each generation understood about Germany's troubled past. This is a very, very interesting part of the interview. And for each generation in terms of what they understood about Nazis, about the Holocaust, where they learned it and how they learned it, and how that all came about for them. So that's in the interviews, and it is quite interesting to listen to it. Okay, so now where am I here? Okay, so when looking through now too, I'm trying to move along fairly quickly here. Through my analysis interpretation, when I finished all the interviews and everything, the first thing that I did was listen through all the interviews several times and to look for and note things like themes and interpretations and images, and while at the same time taking into account things like context, like what were the political and social attitudes of the time when all these things were happening. And what were the beliefs? And I was also looking at gender. And as it turned out, this interview project was primarily woman-centered, not on purpose, but that's just the way the family is organized. And I was also interested in keeping in mind trauma and how trauma helps and how memory helps to protect us from things and from traumas and how to cope with things like that, and what that means then, and how we tell our stories later. I was also keeping in mind sites of memory, things like war history, memorials, medals, remembrances, and how these things fade and become less significant across generations as we move along. And I was thinking of immigration and discrimination and things connected to that, and also, of course, the public and private history. And the discrepancies between public or official history and private stories. And I was also looking for something called foundation stories, and this is a term that I borrowed from Professor Freund's work. And foundation stories are those stories that are repeated by each family narrator in one way or another across the generations, and they're stories that are central to the family memory and from which all other stories are built. And in this study, there's a number of Foundation stories. One, Oma's father, taken by the Russians, Oma's escape across the Berlin Wall, the Russian major who took over a living space in Oma's home when she was a child, Oma's father's notes being smuggled out of prison, the Nazi relative, immigration to Canada, discrimination, the 20-question storybook, which was that little storybook was about, and the German ritual of saying goodbye. So there's lots in there. And as an example of one of these Foundation stories, I've chosen Oma's father, taken by the Russians. And so now you'll get to hear some audio clips of their story, beginning with Oma or Gisela.
Well, then one day came a phone call to my mother. She should tell my father to leave the east part, go as fast as possible to the west, because they are looking for him. And my father was at school. So my mother called him and said he should come home. He said, I can't, I have a meeting. So when he came home, my mother told him, and he said, I have done nothing wrong. I'm not leaving like a thief. I'm staying. And sure enough, the same evening, somebody came from the Gestapo and very polite and said, please, would you come? We have some questions. And he suggested to take a blanket and hot tea. And that was the last thing we saw from our father.
I just wanted to say she suggests that, and then came the Gestapo, and she corrects that later. It was not the Gestapo who came. It was the Russians who came and took her father away. Ms. Marguerite?
You know, or subtle stories like my mom's dad being taken away by the Russians. It all sounds so dramatic and like it's a movie. But it isn't until you get older that you realize, oh, this is a human being who was taken from their home and never came back. And you understand then why my mom had such a hard time talking about it.
Lucas?
But he would go into such detail about like my Oma's family stories, which has to do with a lot of serious heartbreak and like devastation during the war, specifically because her father and her brother died during the war. She actually doesn't know when her father died because he was taken during Russian occupancy and never heard from again. And she just had to come to terms with it at some point.
He was an intellectual man. He wrote the curriculum and textbooks for the country, I think. And so he was not really viewed upon favorably by either the German officials or later the Russian officials when the Russian occupation came, because he was seen as a threat. And he ended up getting put in jail, and that's where he passed away.
So you can begin to see from the clips, you get an idea of how these stories get told and are interpreted and negotiated by each member across the generations, and how that begins to contribute to the shaping of their individual and collective identity and to the shaping of their values and beliefs. And now just a couple of notes of reflection, I guess, from my analysis. In reference to public or official history and private, I'm just noting this, okay, that as in all stories and memories and images held by people about people, events, experiences, and happenings, we know that there is the public or official record of remembrance and history, and then there is the private remembrance of history, and the private stories are the ones that oral history can and do and have uncovered. And research shows that how often there is a pronounced discrepancy between the public and private histories. And I think this is evidenced in this project. For example, since the end of the Second World War, the prevailing public or official record of history has implicated all Germans as Nazi, all Germans as implicit in the Holocaust, and all Germans knew it was happening and did nothing to stop it. Well, just pointing out that this is definitely not a story of Oma's experience, and her father wasn't a Nazi. She was only 6 when the war started, as I said, and 13 when it ended. So her experience was as a child of war. Her experience was of the trauma of living in a war zone, of bombs falling, buildings being bombed out, bullets flying, dead bodies, disappearing family members, hunger and sickness as a child. And as she tells it in her story, first the German guns came, then the American guns came, and then the Russian guns came. Enough pain to last a lifetime. So her experience was not of the Holocaust, and this was something that she began to piece together later on as she grew into her adult life. And just as a point of interest, some examples of other discrepancies in other histories would include, of course, the real story about rape as a weapon of war, and the real story about comfort women, the real story about the Holocaust through the Shoah Project, for example. So following the end of the war, these kinds of stories were publicly silenced, and they were not given a public forum in which these people were allowed to tell these stories. So they could only be told personally and privately. And it wasn't until the 80s that oral history began to bring these stories to public attention. And just a note about the group interview. I want to say something about that. And I have to say that I was skeptical. One of the reasons I wanted to do this kind of interview, because I was kind of skeptical about this group interview thing, and or table talk method of interview, as they call it, for two reasons. One, because I wondered if the setting up of it, like to have to get the family together and set up somehow this interview, I wondered if it might not be too artificial and too staged, perhaps, to be credible. And the other reason was that in my long-time experience as a feminist counselor in both public and private practice, I was not a big supporter of couple counseling practices or group counseling. And although I do appreciate and I do accept that group work can and does serve a very useful purpose in some very good ways, my experience has been that in these situations, there is always one person who never feels totally freed up to say what they need to say. So for a lot of reasons, it could be fear, fear of hurting somebody's feelings, fear of rejection, fear of causing harm to themselves, things like that. So I wasn't sure how it was going to work. And so I told the family about it, and this is how they work, and being the family, oh, yeah, well, you know, we'll have a dinner and do it. And I said, well, no. It can't do an interview and have an eat and do that kind of stuff too. Yeah, okay, no, we can't. All right, then we'll just have a snack. So I thought, well, whatever. Like, I'm not going to. Yeah. And so I thought, well, okay, now how should I set this up and what should I do? And so I got some pictures of Germany and I did this and I had some questions that I thought, you know, we're all sitting around that I could ask and maybe try to get them going. And well, I guess the hellos in German are just as important as the goodbyes in German. So we kind of all arrived, Marguerite and her children and her sister and myself. And so we arrive at Oma's house and everybody gets, I think her sister was already there. It was Marguerite and myself and her children. And so her sister and Oma were already there. Well, there they are, they're watching, and they come out to the curb. Hello, 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 get out of the car. Hello, 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 after the bath. Hang your coats, hello, hello, come in. And we're all carrying food, and it's just food. And this conversation just I realized, I thought at some point, so we all move into the kitchen and food is being here and food is there and it gets on the table and they have this beautiful big 4x8 table and we're all sitting around and it's just talking and talking and we begin eating and then I thought, you know what? I'm not going to have to do anything. So I just got up and I got the mic and put the mic in the middle of the table because it was just fascinating to me how this family, there was this beautiful kind of in and out weaving of stories of present connected to past and past to oh yeah, well, so yeah, Mom, I have to get down into your basement because I have some archives and stuff. Yeah, well, pretty soon, you know, yes, I was going through your stuff. Oh yeah, remember that story when Opa, and then, you know, and then this whole thing just went back and forth and back and forth, and I don't know if it's just unique to this family, but you can really, I could really get an idea of how these stories keep coming in and out in different circumstances and for different reasons. I'm sure they don't do that all the time, but how it's always there and it's always connected. And so you can definitely see that there might be some merit to this kind of interview. Now, that's one of the ones that I haven't transcribed yet because that might be a little difficult to do because, you know, people overlap and people talk. But I know myself, I don't think it would be very difficult because I can certainly define who's speaking and who's saying what. And it was interesting, too, in this family, everybody got a voice. Everybody, you know, the young people could speak and they could really speak their mind and some clearly difficult things are said and exchanged and thought about and discussed. And so it was very interesting. So, anyway, that kind of, is there one more clip there? Yes. This is spelled wrong, T-A-M is supposed to be, Tumbach, and this is Opa's hometown in East Germany. And when they showed me the picture, I was just fascinated. All the little roofs of the houses, they're all red and all white houses, they all look the same. And it was just a very, very pretty picture to me. So that takes care of my presentation. There's much, much, much more, but you can't do it all in half an hour. So I encourage you to go and listen to the interviews. So I don't know if there's any questions or any comments. Yeah.
I'm sort of curious about this, the table talk and that sort of thing. And I was wondering if you found that sort of as people were speaking, there was also like a process of editing going on. Because I know when I'm talking with my family, we start sharing stories, and somebody goes, "No, it didn't happen like that. It was like this." And I was wondering if that sort of
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that happens. And there's editing too in terms of like, I mean, they're you know, as in all interviews, people are careful too about what they will tell you and what they won't tell you. And it's like already mentioned in the first interview, I mean, you know, you do one interview with a person, I mean, you could continue and do one more and one more and one more, and I don't know that you ever get all of the story. But yeah, for this family, there could be no, that wasn't right. Nope, that didn't happen at that time. Oh yeah, that's right, I remember now. And so there would be that kind of stuff. And Mom, remember, what was that story? No, Mom, I remember you telling us that story. So what was that story again? So things like that were happening.
It would be interesting to see how sort of the stories that you identified as sort of foundation stories, how they are for individuals and then how those
Yeah, she's talking about how it would be interesting to hear, like, you know, from the individual stories, you can get a handle on how they identify, and then from the group, you get some idea of how family communicates and identifies collectively as that family. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Was there any sort of, because you had this table talk, which is interesting, was there any point that anybody had to confront, like, a misunderstanding of their past? Like, did anybody have to adjust their own story?
Not overtly. There wasn't anything like that. And I'd have to say, like, it was also, like, a friendly exchange interview. I mean, there was no really, really hard difficult putting somebody on the spot, or I think, like most people, like careful, you get to know, you know, your siblings and your feelings, and I mean, they're not going to say anything publicly that's going to hurt somebody's feelings, and but I think that would be true in individual interview too. So, yeah, I just thought it was an interesting experience, and I don't know yet in my own mind, you know, how relevant it is or isn't relative, but it certainly does give you some idea.
Do you think the table talk interview method could be used in settings other than the family, maybe organizational?
That's sure. You can certainly try that. I mean, you might have to find ways of, you know, okay, how are we going to do this? Are you just going to let people just talk at will, or are you going to put some kind of controls on and making sure you identify who's talking and who's saying what, so that when you go to transcribe it later, you can identify that? I would say go ahead and try. I don't know how it would work, you know, but I would say try it. Yes. Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah, just one thing. If I could just say thank you to, I just want to thank my friend Bev Plett, who helped me create that poster, and she's a graphic artist, and another friend of mine, Carolyn Lutz, who got very, very interested in what I was doing and in oral history and everything, and so I offered to let her transcribe one of the interviews, and so we kind of worked on that together, so thank you, Carolyn. And to Kent Davis, of course, the technical assistant, without, I'd never be able to do any of this stuff. So. And my special thanks to you, the Roger family, to Gisela, Marguerite, daughters Kirsten and daughter Madeline, Kirsten and Marguerite, and then Madeline and Lucas. I express my enormous gratitude. It's your voices that have made this project possible and successful. You invited me into your homes, into your memories and your experiences, both happy and sad. You invited me into some of the most intimate places of your lives. And sometimes when the recorder was turned off, you invited me into places of deepest privacy. And for me, this journey with you has been a gift. So thank you.